Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. In this week's episode, our guests will trace the roots of the Egyptian Revolution, examining the resistance movement that succeeded in toppling Hosni Mubarak. In this hour, we'll hear from Jack Schenker. He's the former Egypt correspondent for The Guardian and author of the book The Egyptians, A Radical Story. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. The broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, David Arnold. He's president of the Asia Foundation and a trustee of the World Affairs Council.
Jack Schenker is an award-winning writer and journalist who is based in London and in Cairo, and whose reporting has spanned the globe. For about 4 years, from 2008 to 2012, Jack was based in Cairo and was the correspondent for The Guardian. And as you will hear tonight, he was on the front lines in terms of coverage of the Egyptian revolution that took place in Tahrir Square in 2011. And his reporting from Egypt has received multiple prizes. More recently, in 2012, his investigation into the deaths of African migrants in the Mediterranean was named as the news story of the year for the One World Media Awards. Tonight, Jack is going to be talking about his new book, which is entitled The Egyptians, A Radical History of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution. And while Jack and I overlapped for several years in terms of his time in Egypt and the time that my wife Sherry and I were there with the American University, his Egypt extends out into the villages in the Nile River Delta and in lots of urban informal settlements. So he really has touched the face and the heart and the soul of Egypt in ways that very few Westerners have an opportunity. So I'm hopeful that he's going to draw on some of that experience in his comments tonight. Welcome, Jack.
Well, thank you very much, David, for that very warm introduction, and to the World Affairs Council for inviting me over. I really appreciate it, and I apologize in advance for the fact that I am completely jet-lagged and exhausted. I feel very discombobulated and slightly kind of unanchored from reality, which is perhaps an appropriate moment to come to the US and given the political context. But yeah, as I said to David before, if I fall asleep on stage, please just prod me awake. I'm going to, if it's okay with you guys, just read a quick extract from the book, just about 10 minutes from the prologue, just to set up what I feel are the themes, not only of the work, but of the way in which I'm trying to conceptualize what's going on in Egypt, the revolution and the counter-revolution, and the way in which it connects with a global moment of disruption that we're living through at the moment. So this is from the prologue. The video is shot from a balcony, and its style is familiar. A shaky handheld camera tracking the action back and forth. Figures below mustering on some unspecified stretch of tarmac and urging one another forward. The chants of the crowd and eventually their screams. Ishab, Yurid, Iskat el Mushir, they bellow again and again. Ishab, Yurid, Iskat el Mushir. The rhythm of the words is like a mounting drumbeat, stealing the children, and they are children. Some almost in their early teens, but most no more than 9 or 10 years old, for the battle ahead. In Arabic, Ishab Yurid Iskat means the people want the downfall of, and El Mushir is the field marshal. Because this is Egypt in early 2012, a year on from the toppling of former President Hosni Mubarak, the field marshal must be General Mohammed Hossein Tantawi, the head of a junta under whose watch more than 100 revolutionary demonstrators have been killed and thousands more have been dragged before military tribunals. Calling for his downfall is a dangerous thing to do. Still, the children chant. And now they've gathered strength in numbers and are staring defiantly at something or someone which stands unseen beyond the left-hand edge of the screen. There are more and more children in the shot, clapping and chanting and feeding off each other's energy. And suddenly, imperceptibly, without a signal from any leader, the air distorts a little Something intangible cracks, and for a moment, the whole world seems to tip on its head and bevel with possibility. You can feel this shift in the blurry pixels. You can feel it surging through the children like a rustle of volts through the bones. You can feel something ineffable is building and building. And now there, it's started. The march begins, and they're advancing, their eyes trained on the prize, off to the left towards that invisible adversary, arms in the air and chests puffed forward. And the jittery camera is following their progress, and that off-screen enemy is silent and watching and waiting. And then there is a noise. And now there is choking and spluttering and shouts and confusion. And everyone begins to turn and run back the way they came. Everyone, that is, but the smattering of children who have dropped to the floor in a heap of clothes and flesh. Everyone but the children now lying completely still amid the madness. And yet, despite all this terror, the fleeing survivors quickly rally themselves and gather in a group once more. The injured and lifeless are retrieved. That melodic drumbeat thuds again in the roofs of the children's mouths. And within moments, the crowd has returned to its starting position, readying themselves for another reckless push into the unknown. Eshab, Yurid, Eskat el-Mushir, they roar. Eshab, Yurid, Eskat el-Mushir. This is Zawiyat el-Dashur School, 20 miles south of Cairo city centre. And what you're watching on screen is playtime. Egypt's revolution has been misunderstood, and a great deal of that misunderstanding has been deliberate. An upheaval that began on the 25th of January 2011, and which will continue yet for many more years to come, has been framed deceptively by elites both within Egypt's borders and beyond. The aim of this deception has been to sanitize the revolution and divest it of its radical potential. Over the past half decade, the Arab world's most populous nation has been engulfed by extraordinary turmoil, the result of millions of ordinary people choosing to reject the status quo and trying instead to build better alternatives. Their struggle against political exclusion and economic exclusion and against the state violence that's required by both for enforcement is not separate from struggles that are playing out elsewhere on the planet, including those in Britain, America, and right across the global north. In fact, they're deeply enmeshed. At the heart of Egypt's unrest are forms of governance that structure all of our lives and modes of resistance that could yet transform them. In the past 5 years, headlines about Egypt have been laden with insta-emotion, awe at an uprising against one of the Middle East's longest reigning and best armed dictators, joy at its success, confusion in its aftermath, sadness that the young protesters were seemingly defeated in the end, that elections were overturned, and the autocrats rose to the summit once again. Right now, far from being a political inspiration, events in Egypt have felt like a textbook example of why mass protest is doomed to failure, a study in how business as usual always wins out in the end. This narrative is profoundly misleading. The revolution and counter-revolution have never just been about Mubarak or his successors or elections. It is not merely a civil war between Islamists and secularists, nor a fight between Oriental backwardness and Western liberal modernity, nor an event that can be fixed and constrained in place or time. In reality, the revolution is about marginalized citizens muscling their way onto the political stage and practicing collective sovereignty over domains that were previously closed to them. The national presidency is one such domain, but there are many others. Factories, fields, and urban streets, the mineral resources that lie under the desert sand and beneath the seabed, the houses people live in, the food they eat and the water they drink. The key players in this drama are not political leaders such as Mubarak, Field Marshal Tantawi, the Muslim Brotherhood's short-lived President Mohamed Morsi, or the army general who overthrew him, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Elites and counter-elites jockeying for supremacy amid the chaos, but rather the ordinary Egyptians fighting for autonomy and attempting to dismantle the constellation of power which enables such supremacy in the first place. They are women and men who often look very different from the demonstrators who appeared in front of international television cameras during the original anti-Mubarak uprising. Women and men who, for the most part, live a long way from Tahrir Square. They are the farmers revolting against the privatization of their land, the DJs creating illicit new music in backstreet garages, the ceramics plant employees kidnapping their boss and seizing control of their workplace, the Bedouins storming a nuclear site to reclaim stolen territory, the schoolchildren who spend their lunch breaks playing games of revolution in Zayat al-Dashur. Their stories rarely make it into the international media, but within them lies the revolution's threat and its living, giddying possibilities. By the time we reached El Marazaki Bridge, which links Helwan to the west bank of the Nile, the sun had disappeared and the bridge's giant metal girders were dimming with the last of the day's light. On the far side of the river, everything was onyx green. Our driver lit another cigarette and wound down the window. The dust storm, which had dogged us throughout our ride from the station, seemed to have finally eased off, and through the growing shadows, we could make out clumps of palms and reed-strewn lagoons. Ghamrawi nudged me and pointed at a shimmer of light to the south, beyond a large expanse of open land. It had to be Zayat al-Dashur. I recognized the school straight away from the video. Tidy red brick blocks with wraparound external walkways, a bare set of goalposts on the ground below. It was late, but a few lights were on. Past the open gate, some children were playing football in the playground, the same playground where they had reenacted revolutionary clashes against the security forces during their lunch break. It was only by the merest chance that a visiting medic had been up on a balcony that day and recorded a fuzzy minute of footage on his mobile phone. The film later went viral on YouTube. "Egypt's next president will come from this generation," wrote the medic in his online caption for the video. Hundreds of people commented below the line. "What a tribute to the Egyptian people," said one viewer. Another wrote, "This means there will be a lifetime of revolution." A man emerged from a door on the edge of the playground and walked across to ask what we were doing there. He was a young maths teacher. And after we explained that we wanted to see the school where the YouTube video had been shot, he invited us back to the staff room for tea. "You have no idea how obsessively the children throw themselves into it," he confided. "That video became a bit famous, but it was just 1 minute of footage. They've been playing like that since the revolution started, during every break time, and again when classes finish at the end of the day. Sometimes they do it 20 times in a row, pretending to attack the police, miming being shot and gassed, and then picking themselves up again to carry on the fighting." I said to him that it was brave of them to chant so openly against the army, and the teacher shook his head and laughed. "They're braver than that," he replied. "The sound on the video is very crackly, so people didn't realise. Everyone who watched it thought the children were calling for the downfall of the mushir, the field marshal. But actually they were yelling, 'Ishab yurid iskat el-mudir,' the people want the downfall of the headmaster. They weren't just copying what they saw on the television, they were changing it to carry out their own mini revolution right here in the school." He poured out some more tea and shoveled a small mountain of sugar into each glass. "The children are completely different now. Within 2 minutes of the revolution starting, they began speaking out in class, challenging things the teachers said, asking us about what was happening on the streets and what it all meant. Some of the staff, including me, had participated in the protests in Tahrir, and the students wanted to know everything. They wanted to know how it felt to have a voice at last. We changed, and they changed with us." Outside, the football game had come to an end. As we emerged from the staff room into the playground, the children flocked around us, clambering over one another's shoulders in an effort to be in one of Ghamrawi's photos. "We hated him," shouted one, when I asked why they'd been trying to bring down the headmaster, who has, sure enough, now departed from the school. "I don't want to be rude," added another sternly, "but he was a thief. We've had enough of corruption. Also, he wouldn't let us have a football tournament, even though he promised us one the year before." Several heads nodded vigorously in agreement. "We saw the revolution on the television, and we learned that if you want to change something in your life, this is what you do," interjected one small boy named Ahmed, who ran the zip of his tracksuit top up and down as he spoke. "I'm sorry," he concluded, "but the football tournament is a red line." Today, many of Egypt's revolutionaries are locked behind bars, but this conceptualization of revolution, not just the toppling of a figurehead like the mushir, but a far deeper reimagining of power and sovereignty, one capable of sweeping away the Mudir and many others like him in its wake, is proving far harder for the state to vanquish. Contained within it is courage and hope that belongs to us all. The kids reeled off a list of the ways in which their lives had changed since the revolution began. The school bullies, who the other children refer to as the playground shorta, or police, had been chased away. In classes, students regularly walked out if they felt disrespected and refused to be yelled at anymore by the teachers. I asked one of the quieter children for his thoughts, and he pondered silently for a moment, shyly biting his finger. "The Egyptian people are lions," he concluded at last, looking up at me. "We always shouted, but now we roar." Thank you very much. And I will save my slightly less optimistic take on what's going on in Egypt at the moment for our discussion.
Thank you very much, Jack, for that wonderful excerpt and introduction. The title of your book is A Radical History of Egypt's Unfinished Revolution. And I wanted to ask you to elaborate a little bit on what makes your history a radical history.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things I found working as a newspaper correspondent in Cairo for many years was that not only is the format of a kind of 600-word news article a very inadequate one to get across the nuances and the subtleties of what was going on in Egypt at that time, but also that the lens trained on Egypt by the mainstream media left a lot out and was often very skewed. And that was the case before the revolution began. In 2006, the BBC ran a profile of Egypt to mark Hosni Mubarak's 25th year in power, in which they said Hosni Mubarak enjoys widespread support on the streets of Egypt and there are no signs of unrest. Now, in 2006, there had already been a massive rural essentially uprising against the land reforms of the late 90s, which dismantled Gamal Abdel Nasser's socialization of the fields. There had been the Kefaya movement, which was a pro-democracy movement largely based in the urban centers of Cairo and Alexandria, but which had required the state to drag all of the furniture of repression out into the streets to quieten it. That very year, just before they wrote this profile, there was an uprising in the textiles town of Mahal al-Kubra in the Nile Delta, in which the security forces went into the town and shot three people dead. So this notion that Egypt was static and stable and quiet, a place where things used to happen, where there were pyramids and mummies, but nothing very interesting had gone on in recent years, was wholly false. And it led people to miss the key drivers of the revolution. And I worried after the 18 days and after the fall of Mubarak that this mistake was being repeated once again at every single stage. So I think what makes it radical is that it tries to take a different approach and say, first of all, as I alluded to in the prologue, the revolution was not an event that can be fixed in space or time. It's not something that happened in Tahrir and can be walled off and plastic wrapped and celebrated. And it's not something that's over. And I don't say that from an overly romanticized kind of, you know, vaguely hopeful perspective. Things in Egypt are incredibly dark right now. But I believe that the violence we're seeing at the moment and the repression we're seeing is precisely because we're at the beginning of a historical period of unrest, right, in which two clashing power models are taking place, are fighting it out and duking it out, and there will be many, many more waves to come. So that, among other things, is the radical component. That and the length, you know, because it is a bit much. It doubles as an offensive weapon. If you're building barricades at the moment against Trump, it's very useful.
Even though you've described this movement and the revolution as a process, not a single event, you were in Tahrir Square at that historic moment, and I think for much of the world, their attention was very much focused on, something absolutely unprecedented in Egypt and in the history of the Middle East. From your experience, I mean, can you just give us just a few glimpses of what are your most vivid memories of being there during that historic, regime changing, world changing time?
it was the most exciting, discombobulating, mind-scrambling time of my life, personally and politically. I have lots of vignettes in the book. I tried to make it not a journalistic memoir of running in and out of tear gas and getting locked up in police vans and so on and so on, even though all of those things happened. But I do have one chapter where I try and convey some of the emotion, the visceral emotion of being caught up in all of that. And the thing I think I'm among the small number of people who care about what journalists in Egypt are doing, the thing that I'm known for is actually on the night the revolution began, being arrested and being roughed up and thrown into a police truck and driven out into the desert, where thankfully I had my dictaphone. They'd taken my mobile and my wallet, but they forgot to check for the dictaphone, so I managed to record from inside this this paddy wagon, and we managed to escape from the police truck eventually. I'm waiting for the film rights, and the sort of James Bond-esque. But actually, when I think back in answer to your question, that's not the key memory. The key memory is going past the house on the corner of the street in which I live, which is this old sort of Belle Epoque. It's a weird building. It's got sort of gargoyles on it. It's half ruined and it's falling apart. And it's at a really strategic location because it's between Meydan Abdelmonem Riyad and Meydan Tahrir, where obviously the main occupation was. Yeah. And people attacking the square were coming from Abdelmonem Riyad. So if you could get on top of this house and throw rocks, you could keep people back. And I was walking past and interviewing people, and there was a line of people carrying rocks, ferrying them up the stairs, and someone just handed me some rocks and assumed I was going to pitch in. And I did, because it felt ludicrous not to. Mm-hmm. And that's not what an objective, so-called objective, I find the idea of journalistic objectivity quite ridiculous, but that's not what a BBC or a CNN correspondent would have done or is supposed to do, but it felt the absolute right thing to do. And I ended up having sort of squatting in this corner of this house, all this weird marble and dust around me. And I'd pick, because we ran out of notebooks, we ran out of pens, my notebooks from that period are scrunched up, and their sheets spill everywhere, and there are teardrops on it, and you know the stuff of revolution is caught up in them. All the shops were closed. I ended up at some point getting a notebook, because I didn't have anything else to write in, from an abandoned, empty hotel gift shop, and it was actually an address book, and it was a preposterous fake leather, golden gilt edged thing, and because it was designed for Arabic writing and I write in English, I flipped it over, and in the process I upended a world map that was in the inside cover, and I opened this book and stared at it, and the world was the wrong way up, and I wrote on it, the world turned upside down. And that's how I felt that entire time, and it was incredibly energizing.
Great. So in the book you describe the period leading up to the revolution as Mubarak country. Mm. And you refer to Mubarak country again in the kind of post-Morsi, post-revolution period. And I'm particularly interested in your thoughts about Egypt today under President el-Sisi, and what you experienced and observed and write about in terms of the later Mubarak years. How do you compare where Egypt is today in terms of human rights, governance, freedom, to what existed prior to the revolution?
Well, this will be the depressing section of the evening, because the Sisi regime, and this is not just my personal impression, you speak to human rights defenders, you speak to people from marginalized communities, you speak to civil society, novelists, journalists, Facebook page administrators, anyone who attempts to have an individual voice that doesn't conform with the state's narrative in Egypt at the moment, and they will tell you that the scale of repression is much fiercer and wilder than it was under Mubarak. Mubarak Country 2.0 is not a cheerful place to be. Right. What I try and argue in the book, and there's a new afterword as well in this American edition, which is also available online, and I refer to this in a New York Times piece I wrote last week, is that the mistake would be to look at that level of repression and assume that the clock has turned back and we are back with a default. You know, Sisi is, for the West, many of his Western allies, a familiar face in an unfamiliar region. He is the strong man, fresh out of khakis, who isn't particularly nice, but is keeping the country in control. And, you know, we can basically scrub that awkward half decade of political unrest in Egypt and return to where we started. There is a reason that's wrong. And there is a reason that this regime's repression is so wild, and fierce and fragmented, mm-hmm. And that's the other thing, that it's you know, the regime often engages in self-defeating acts of repression, unlike Mubarak, and the reason is that the political landscape beneath their feet has been completely rearranged by revolution and counter-revolution. This is not a government that has just picked up the reins of the old state and said, well, let's carry on where we left off. This is a government that is walking a tightrope, and it is swaying from the contradictions that it's being forced to navigate. And I still believe that it will not reach the end of that tightrope. It will fall off, and we can maybe in the discussion get to some of the reasons that I believe those contradictions are so deep, and the veneer of so-called stability is so thin. But yeah, that the key takeaway is the fact that this is not just a return to Mubarak Country. This is an attempt to layer Mubarak Country onto a landscape that has completely changed. And that's the reason why things are so dark.
Jack, between Mubarak 1.0 and Mubarak 2.0, there was a brief interregnum with the Muslim Brotherhood and also a period of a military junta. In your book, you describe kind of an almost symbiotic relationship in some ways between the military and the Muslim Brotherhood in the first instance, and then a fairly dramatic falling out. Can you kind of describe for all of us kind of the process and what transpired in terms of getting from the departure of Mubarak to the overthrow of Morsi and the ultimate, you know, election of the general al-Morsi as the new president? There was a pretty, I think, for many Westerners, it was a period of time that was really difficult and challenging to understand what was really going on.
There's a writer, an American woman actually, called Ursula Lindsay, who spent a long time in Egypt and writes fantastically on the subject. And she refers to a period in early 2013 when the Muslim Brotherhood President Morsi was still in office, but there were huge protests against him playing out on the streets. And she said, these days in Cairo, the paving stones disappear beneath your feet because they're being taken up, you know, to be thrown at security forces. But she also meant it sort of intellectually and analytically. And you're absolutely right that, I mean, firstly, even if what had happened in Egypt in those years was uncontested, it would still take hours to sift through all of its nuances. But of course, it's not uncontested. The way in which what happened in those years is framed is very different depending on whether you're a supporter of the state, if you're an Islamist and supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood, or whether you're coming at it from a different angle altogether. Very, very briefly, I argue in the book that the Muslim Brotherhood, despite the fact that they have and had many ordinary members up and down the country who dreamed of a far more just and democratic Egypt and were on the front line of the revolution, the Muslim Brotherhood institutionally in terms of its leadership under Morsi, more accurately under Khedira Sheta, who was more of the power behind the throne, was never a revolutionary force. That they were willing to occupy organs of state power that had become available to them because of the unrest provoked by the revolution, but economically and politically, they were determined to resist revolutionary pressure to truly break open and democratize the state. That particularly goes for their kind of financial policies, but also for their willingness to use the security apparatus against dissent. I mean, Mohamed Ibrahim, the interior minister who oversaw the Rabah massacre, in which around a thousand Muslim Brotherhood supporters were killed in the streets, was an appointee of Morsi's. General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi was an appointee of Morsi's. This stuff has to be remembered. People often ask, was the downthrow of Morsi, the overthrow of Morsi, sorry, was it a coup? Was it a popular uprising? The point is that the two are not mutually exclusive. There was genuine revolutionary movement against Morsi on the streets. There was also an establishment a plot to harness and exploit that revolutionary energy to put the old guard of the Ancien Régime back in the fiefdoms, which they felt they'd been unfairly ousted from. So that's how I see it. I think it's just very important to say, though, that although I am very critical of the Muslim Brotherhood in the book, and particularly the Muslim Brotherhood's leadership, I think as journalists, as writers, as authors or analysts, it matters where we train our lens, right? We're not objective cameras. Where we choose to focus our attention is a political choice. And under Morsi, I was interested in exposing and criticizing and trying to illuminate the depths of the Muslim Brotherhood's non-revolutionary power. But right now, it is Muslim Brotherhood supporters who are being gunned down on Fridays when they try and protest. It is Muslim Brotherhood supporters who are languishing in jail entirely unfairly and being condemned to death in mass death sentences. So the important thing now is not to hark back to those failures, but to look at the real enemy, I believe, of a just and democratic Egypt, which is the old guard, the state, and the military regime.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Jack Schenker. He's the former Egypt correspondent for The Guardian and author of the book The Egyptians, A Radical Story. He's in conversation with David Arnold, president of the Asia Foundation. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. World Affairs is a membership organization. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our conversation.
In the book, you go back and trace the evolution from pre-Nasser times through the reforms and nationalist and socialist agenda of the Nasser regime, and then the beginnings of the liberalization under Sadat. And the question from our audience has to do with this movement of the neoliberal agenda, which you describe as being encouraged, supported in substantial measure by Western governments, USAID, World Bank, IMF, the Washington Consensus. And the question that's been posed is, if economic liberalism and privatization are the primary problems that are facing the Egyptian people, what is the alternative and what would you see as a possible solution to this?
It's an excellent question and one that doesn't have an easy answer. If I was stocked with ready-made solutions to the world's economic injustices, then, well, I'd be a less tired and richer man than I am. The key thing that I try and get to in the book and highlight is the fact that the narrative that economic liberalization goes hand in hand with political liberalization, Egypt gives the lie to that narrative. The only way in which the reforms that began under Sadat, Anwar Sadat, as you said, but really intensified firstly in 1991 when Egypt signed up to a structural adjustment program sponsored by the IMF, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the shape of structural adjustment programs in the global south, mass privatization, a rolling back of workers' rights, an attempt to inject more private enterprise and competition into the economy. The only way that that was successful, in inverted commas, and that it was possible to be implemented was because of the exclusionary and violent state apparatus that the state relied on to remain in power. As one small example, I talk about a village in the Nile Delta, which was one of thousands that tried to resist land reform, you know, land reform which was encouraged by international financial institutions and Egypt's Western allies. And I described the siege that began when the police surrounded it and the violence that was meted out against that population. That neoliberal agenda relied on violence, as I think it does in many parts of the world. In terms of alternatives, I would almost twist the question back round and say, what possibility is there of what we are now seeing, which is a return to the old ideas of market liberalization, free market fundamentalism, but marshalled by a series of military generals that provide the kind of gatekeepers to a liberalised economy for international investors and for Gulf capital, which is exactly what we're seeing under Sisi. What solution is that? It's no solution. We've tried that. I was at an economic conference called Egypt the Future in 2015, where Christine Lagarde was there and Tony Blair was there. And of course, Tony Blair was there. Whenever an autocrat is handing out Danish pastries, Tony Blair is there. And, you know, it was like the soundtrack to this event should have been the Lego movies, Everything is Awesome, because people were going around saying, guys, we've had this great idea. We're going to pursue this sort of GDP growth orientated liberalization of the market, where basically the military sells off huge portions of Egypt's infrastructure to private investors, and then everything's going to be fine. And I just wanted to put my hand up and say, sorry, does no one remember that that was exactly what was going on? So in the moments where the revolution was in a healthier state and where revolutionaries were able to shape the narrative a bit more, there were really exciting economic ideas about collective ownership of factories, about rejecting odious debt which had been accumulated from international financial institutions by an illegitimate regime. We could talk about the potential possibilities for economic alternatives all day, but I think the key thing to say right now is the status quo doesn't work.
Great. This question has to do with Egypt's position in the region, and it's obviously in a very dynamic and a very troubled region, but the question is really, what role does the regional setting and do regional interactions and the forces at work around the Middle East actually shape Egypt's position and its options in the current moment?
A really good question, and one I think you can come at in three important ways. The first being that what is happening in the region quite obviously in terms of state failure in countries like Libya, Syria, Iraq, to a certain extent, is something that has been weaponized domestically for domestic consumption in terms of the regime justifying its existence and saying very persuasively at times, listen, without us, human rights may not be on the agenda right now and we may not be having genuine free and fair elections, but if we weren't here, look at Aleppo. That's what you'd be looking at. So in terms of the way in which the regional context affects Egyptian domestic politics, that's very important. The second thing is that Egypt is obviously a hugely important geopolitical player. The Camp David Agreement is, from an American perspective, the bedrock of stability, what stability there is in the Middle East. But at the moment, it is somewhat shifting its alliances under Sisi. I mean, for those who follow this stuff very closely, more closely than me, they'll know that Egypt's relationship with Saudi Arabia, which was its strongest regional ally, is coming under a lot of pressure at the moment. In terms of Syria, Egypt has pivoted slightly to Putin's position, which has really angered, again, some of its Gulf allies and America and Britain and some of its other kind of Western sponsors. So it is attempting to sort of diversify its regional support base. But I think what's important, and the third element of this, is all of this is happening against the backdrop of Egypt attempting to, or the Egyptian government attempting to restore, or claiming it is trying to restore Egypt's role as a regional leader. And there is a really interesting trajectory of, you know, in the 1960s, Egypt was the center of the world, certainly the center of the Arab world. At times, it felt like the center of the whole world.
Umm Dunya,
exactly. You know, when Kulthum sang and Yusuf Shaheen directed and Gamal Abdel Nasser hosted, you know, the rest of the Arab nationalists and pan-Arabism, and, you know, they kicked the British out of the Suez Canal and dictated things. And then you have, under Anwar Sadat, a real decline in Egyptian regional influence and the rise of the Gulf petrodollar states instead. And in some ways, Egypt psychologically has never quite recovered from that and is now trying to reassert itself. But it's doing it at a time where the landscape around it is incredibly complicated.
This question, I think, is very timely, and it, there are two or three that refer to the political changes in the U.S., but I think this one is a nice way to frame it, and that is how the current populist U.S. and U.K. attitudes are treating Sisi, and what effect, if any, Trump's election may have in terms of autocratic forms of government in the region.
I mean, it's interesting to bring Britain into it, you know, in terms of the political moment that we're living through. We, as ever, you know, Britain thinks that it can do stuff best, in this case, kind of crazy lurches to the political right. And every time we think we've nailed it, America manages to trump us, no pun intended, a few months later. I mean, there are many, many ways into this. I mean, the very direct answer to the question is that Sisi was obviously delighted by Trump's victory. There was a strong overlap between Sisi's more vocal support base and the sort of alt-right social media sphere in the US. It was really interesting seeing memes about Hillary Clinton being repurposed for domestic use in Egypt, references to, you know, Hillary Clinton having founded the Muslim Brotherhood and other well-known facts like that. But just to say, I think the Trump-Sisi parallels, which all the events I've done, these questions come up, and quite rightly, but they can be overstated and they can be incredibly reductive. The context in Egypt is incredibly different from that in the US. The depth of authoritarian violence that Egyptians face every single day is on a completely different scale. It's so obvious that it shouldn't need to be said, but it's just worth pointing that out so that what I'm going to say next isn't too reductive. And it's also worth pointing out as well that although I think Trump and Sisi both have emerged out of really a global moment of breakdown in the prevailing political order, they are very different in the sense that Trump disingenuously, but nonetheless, styles himself as an insurgent against the establishment, whereas part of Sisi's appeal is that he is a creature of the establishment and represents the old order. So it's very, very important to keep those differences in mind. Having said all that, the mutually reinforcing worldviews that Sisi and Trump hold certainly involve a sort of messianic belief in exceptionalism. So in Trump's case, that is temporal, in that, you know, America is facing an existential threat from radical Islamist terrorism, and so that is why democratic norms and so on need to be scaled back somewhat. In Sisi's case, it's temporal for the same reasons, and it's also cultural. You know, Europe and America don't understand that Egypt's in a special situation and a democracy isn't right for them. And all of that is wrapped up with an incredible chauvinistic nationalism. You know, make America great again, Haybat al-Dawla, which means the prestige of the state, which is constantly invoked in Egypt to silence opponents. But it's also the interesting parallel as well is the fact that I think both Trump and Sisi see themselves, as all authoritarian populists do, as somehow representing the single authentic will of the people, the silent majority. And I think that when you come in with that attitude, you begin to see politics itself as something that's corrosive, because politics involves intermediaries. It involves debate. It involves you saying something which I might not agree with, but we can debate and discuss and thrash out our differences. When the new Suez Canal was opened, which is something that's cost Egypt billions of dollars and was said to be the greatest project essentially since the pyramids. I'm not sure why the original Suez Canal wasn't included in the list of great things. But anyway, that has resulted in a 0.0033% increase in Egypt's Suez Canal revenues. But if journalists ever try and make that point to Sisi, he says, and this is a quote, "To question national projects in Egypt is an attempt to break the will of the Egyptian people." The parliamentary speaker in Egypt, when a group of MPs tried to raise criticisms to some of the provisions in a draft VAT law, I mean, you can't get much more technocratic than this, the parliamentary speaker referred them to a disciplinary committee because to question the draft VAT law is to question Egypt. Mm. And when I hear Steve Bannon saying the press is an opposition party, I, again, with all of the qualifications that I said earlier about the differences in context, I hear similar notes about who has a right to dissent. And when I see, for example, the removal of the acting attorney general, it wasn't the removal that bothered me, although obviously it disturbed me, but it was the statement that the White House put out in which they essentially, I'm paraphrasing here, suggested that she didn't care about national security, she didn't care about the welfare of Americans. Not that she had a disagreement with them about the best way to keep Americans secure, but no, she didn't care. And again, after living under various authoritarian populists in Egypt for many years, that set alarm bells ringing.
So one of the questions that's posed here is whether that coming revolution and the forces that are still at work will be manifest in terms of Islamist revolution or secular forces trying to bring about change. And second, related to that, is given the unstable political climate in the region, you think that there is a vulnerability to a revolution that may end up going from a bad regime to an even worse alternative going forward. If, in fact, the revolution is an ongoing work in progress, where is it headed? What are the forces that are going to drive it? And what would you see as the potential outcomes of the next wave of revolution?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, they're both huge, huge questions. I mean, I guess briefly on the Islamist versus secular fault line, I talk about Islamism and secularism in the book. I also talk about the ways in which I find that distinction unhelpful, not because it's irrelevant, but because I think that, especially in 2013, when Morsi was on his way out and Sisi was on his way in, that was often used as the primary lens to kind of understand what was going on in Egypt. And although I think it's very relevant, and certainly the institutional politics of the Muslim Brotherhood are very important in terms of understanding what's been going on in Egypt, I don't think that's the primary division within Egypt's political landscape. I believe that there is a breakdown of an old order in Egypt. To paraphrase Gramsci, you know, the old world is broken, but the new is not yet formed. And there are those in Egypt who believe in a traditional patriarchal top-down model of power, and there are those that believe in fighting for alternatives. And there are Islamists on both sides of that divide, and there are secularists both on both sides of that divide. And you see that divide within religious institutions, and this is something I really try and get into in the book, within mosques, within the church, I mean, within the Coptic church, which the leadership of which has long been co-opted by the state. There are fascinating things going on in terms of the laity, the Maspero Youth Union challenging the right of church leaders to assert a political voice on their behalf. I interview a Salafist, a fascinating guy who has all these stories about trying to drive to Hurghada with his wife to go sunbathing and getting stopped by security, who saw him with his big beard and said, "What are you you're not going to the beach. That's not what Salafists do. And throwing him into prison and locking him up with state security. And he has this great line where he said, as soon as Mubarak fell, the first thing I did is jump in a car and in my swimming trunks and drive to Hurghada. But the point is, he has come up against both the Muslim Brotherhood and Salafist conservative institutions in terms of that model of power, him coming from a more revolutionary perspective. So, I just don't think it's the most helpful way in which to understand what's going on in Egypt. In terms of where we're going, the vulnerability to worse alternatives, that vulnerability is there. I'm not someone who is ever going to sit here and say, because we're going through this historical moment that I've been talking about, in which new waves of unrest are inevitable, that inevitably means that there is a rainbow at the end of it all, and that we're looking at a bright and happy future. I think there may be many, many more dark days ahead. The point is that people like me saying one way or the other, this would be better or this would be worse, is completely irrelevant. The median age of the population in the US is somewhere in the mid-30s. In Germany, I think it's 47. In Egypt, it's 24. There are 50 million Egyptians under the age of 30. And these kids and young adults have grown up in their most formative years with revolution as their backdrop. The interviews I've done with dozens and dozens of revolutionaries often begin not with fights with the police in Tahrir Square. It's fights with mums and dads in the family dining room and people leaving scribbled notes on their bedroom door saying, Yas God, Hosni Mubarak, and down with Mubarak, and climbing out the bedroom window so they could go and join the protests. There are tens of millions of Egyptians for whom the reality of confronting patriarchal power, state power, the notion that they shouldn't have a voice and autonomy and the right to shape the environment around them will not wash anymore. And I talked about the children in Zawiya del Dashour school at the beginning. Those kids were 9 or 10 years old half a decade ago when I interviewed them. So now they're 15, 16. And this past summer, there are exams called the Sanawiya Ama, which every Egyptian student has to take when they reach the end of high school. These exams set your whole professional future. And there's always problems and corruption and leaks. And this year, lots of the exams had to be cancelled. And what do these kids do when their exams were cancelled and their futures were in jeopardy? They came out onto the streets to protest. And that's despite the fact that there is a protest law, which means you can be locked up indefinitely for trying to demonstrate. It's despite the fact that there is a terrorism law which allows the state to designate anyone it doesn't like a militant and add you to trials where 500, 600, 700 people get sentenced to death at the same time. These kids came out because this is what they know. It was Ramadan, and so most of the kids were fasting. They couldn't even drink water. And yet here they were with onions and soda for the tear gas because they help counteract the effects, throwing rocks at armoured police vehicles. There's a quote from a kid called Mustafa saying, the police keep coming, we keep coming, this is what we do. And I think that in terms of thinking about the future, me saying this alternative would be better, this alternative would be worse, is completely irrelevant. This is the generational divide that will shape Egypt for many years to come. And anyone who thinks that it can just be swept under the carpet is deluding themselves.
So I think you've pointed to the answer to the question that I'm about to pose, and that has to do with the fact that you've painted in the book, and I think all of us looking at the current situation in Egypt see a fairly depressing picture and a pretty sobering reality, and as you say, dark days ahead. And yet your book, as you've described the ending, does end on a hopeful note, and it's glimmers of light on the horizon. And is that purely a function of this next generation that you've alluded to, or are there other things that make you a little bit more, not, if not optimistic, at least hopeful about what the future may hold?
It's my cheery disposition, largely, I think, that keeps me going. No, I mean, the generational divide that I've been referring to is crucial, but it comes on the back of something that I mentioned before, which was the essential contradictions that characterize the current regime and its model of power. just very, very briefly, for those that don't follow Egypt closely, as I'm sure most people in this room do, and we have a lot more knowledge about this kind of stuff than me, but the regime is riddled with contradictions. Just to take one example, it has to cultivate this chauvinistic nationalism that we were talking about to justify its existence. So it has to whip up this incredibly ferocious sense of patriotism and of Egyptian national sovereignty and pride. At the same time, it's completely reliant, again, as we were referring to earlier, on regional allies like Saudi Arabia. And for those that don't know, there are two contested Red Sea islands called Tiran and Sanafir, which are run by Egypt, are essentially administered by Egypt, but have always been claimed by Saudi Arabia. And one of the things that Sisi has had to do to keep Saudi Arabia happy is hand over these islands back to Saudi Arabia. Now, when he attempted to do this, thousands and thousands of Egyptians took to the streets. And I'm not talking about your anarcho-leftist student types. I'm talking about Sisi supporters who were outraged at the fact that in this moment of national pride, these, you know, forever Egypt lands could be hived off to a foreign power. That's the kind of contradiction which is going to keep on coming to haunt it. Giulio Regini, for those that know that name, a young Cambridge PhD student from Italy, who was found murdered this time, tragically, last year, with signs of torture all over his body that were entirely consistent with the practices we know that are used by the Egyptian security services. Hosni Mubarak would never have allowed his security forces to kill a white European because it's counterintuitive, it's unnecessary, it causes all kinds of problems in terms of international relations. And sure enough, in terms of Giulio Regini's death, Italy was forced, not because it has any moral compass of these things, but because of its own domestic political pressure, to withdraw its ambassador. The reason Giulio Regini was killed is not because Sisi wanted a white European to be found dead on the outskirts of Cairo, but because he is not fully in control of the institutions of the state, because he has had to, in an attempt to renormalize state power and state violence and the right of the state to practice that violence on Egyptian citizens, reconstruct the security services and hand lots and lots of power to these different competing fiefdoms, and yet he's not able, precisely because of the fact that the landscape has been so rearranged, as we've been talking about, to maintain tight control over them. And so things like this keep happening, and they will go on happening. The pendulum will swing again. You know, we are in a very, very, very dark moment, and I think the days to come could be darker yet. But we mustn't miss the wood for the trees. The present conjunction of economic injustice, state violence and political powerlessness, which characterized Egypt for many years before the revolution, is not sustainable. That's not what stability looks like, no matter what President Sisi or his international backers like Trump and Theresa May. You know, David Cameron invited Sisi to Downing Street and rolled out the red carpet for him. No matter what they say, the pendulum will swing again, and I believe that this attempt, whether or not it will be successful, to assert popular sovereignty from below and overtop these walls that have been placed around the old state, those attempts will continue for many, many more years to come.
So I'd like to invite all of you to join me in thanking our guest, Jack Schenker, for a really inspiring, if somewhat sobering, presentation. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This conversation featured Jack Schenker. He's the former Egypt correspondent for The Guardian and the author of the book, The Egyptians, A Radical Story. He was in conversation with David Arnold, who's president of the Asia Foundation. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Stanton Burns. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.